Special number 17754, Mr. Benny Gordon, Reel 4.
Benny Gordon, Reel 4. So we're really talking about you going to Oxford while you were in England, before you left for D-Day.
That's correct.
Yes, when you signed this form, really behind your officer's back.
That's correct.
Yes,
that's correct.
He would have stopped it. Mm-hmm. Yes, so going up to Oxford, what was your impressions of the place?
I had never had the pleasure of going into a world-renowned... Oh, it was the just the environment was so good. I just loved it.
Which college?
And there was a wall around it, stone, paved wall, and it's set up, you know, and all. It was so, it looked so prestigious. And I went to Baylor, Ballyl College, Oxford University.
You lived in college, did you, Benny?
Yes. Yes.
Who were the other students? Who were the other people?
You had people, soldiers there from Canada, and I should have that role of 10 days at Oxford in that time, and it had their names and where they were from, what country they were from, because it wasn't all Americans. It was you had people there from Canada, I think, had some there from Norway, and there was another country. Oh, several countries, I forgot. It's a mixture of countries.
Mm-hmm. And how did you all get on? Would you have been the only Afro-American, do you think?
Well, I was the only... I didn't see another Afro-American there. As I say, the only reason I got there was because I was in a position to know what was going on. All of these people there were white. And I met a fella, I can't think of his name now, but I think he was from Norway. And we were, well, you know, just discussing like we discuss here. I don't know, post-war reconstruction is what we were all about.
Is that what you were doing?
Yes, post-war reconstruction.
Who were your lecturers? Did you have good people?
We had very good people, and I don't know their names now. I've forgotten their names.
Did you learn much, Benny?
Well, yes, because it was different. And to exchange of ideas, to know what they're thinking, exchange. It's a learning process. Something that I didn't know, never thought of. And one of the fellows there, trying to think of what nationality he was, gave me a pen as a token, and it had, it was something of his country. And I had that, I cherished that. And somehow, some way, our government is so strange that is not a GI issue, and it was complicated. Something about it was a form, meant something that I don't know anything about. But I didn't. I thought it was a gift of sincerity, you know. And what they claimed that it wasn't GI issued, I mean government issued, and that they thought it meant something foreign to our government that I don't know about.
Did you get out into the town as well? You know, while you were at Balliol, did you?
No, they had. There were people that came to the college for tea, and we had a dance and all that kind of thing. These were people that you would say from the upper crust, you know, that you met, and I thought that was good because you, of course, they know how to put on two faces, and I don't know what their thinking was, but I could tell since that they were trying to seek for some answers, probably that they had been misguided or what have you. I don't know, but from they were very inquisitive about certain things, social problems, and that's about it. But we had, they prepared tea, and they had some, they call them crunkets. What are the crunkets?
Crumpets.
Crumpets and tea. And then there was another group that came, and they had, what's it, bitters?
They had
bitters?
Bitters.
Beer.
Bitter beer.
Yes. Oh, yes, you had beer. Yeah. Because I didn't like it. I couldn't drink it. But anyway, they had that, and mainly the tea and crumpets are very good.
What did your officer, how did he react when he found that you had been to Oxford?
Well, first thing, the orders were cut, and he couldn't help it, and he did to Oxford. He didn't know what was happening. He could care less. I'm back. See, and the fellow that that took my place while I was gone, he didn't have hardly anything to do, but because everything was laid out for him, you know, so. No problem.
That's an amazing experience for you, really, isn't it?
It really was.
But do you know of any other Afro-American that went to Oxford?
I don't know. I've not one.
And then you say you went to Barrett's,
yes,
as well. Was that a similar sort of event?
Well, that was better because that was longer, and we got we were taking academic courses rather than a specialized course. English, business law, and we had literature. As a matter of fact, you had all of the university courses there at the Ritz.
How long were you there?
Oh, I was there for about all semester. Yeah.
And that would have been after the war, would it?
Yes, I was after the war. See, I waived my right to come home to go there, to attend there, because I was anxious to, well, not only relax, but just to get into a different culture.
And how? What was life like there for you? You know, were you accepted by the people?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. It was. See, this is why education, knowledge is so important. It's power. Very good. And this is what I admonish the university here. They have the power, but they don't exercise it. They are afraid for fear that that they may lose some donors.
Yes, knowledge.
And it's more powerful than the money.
Yes, knowledge is power. Yes, I do accept your point, Benny. There was also a GI Bill at the end of the war.
Yes.
Was this, you know, education at Billets part of that?
No. See, that was a different deal overseas, that the government... See, there was no way that the government could get all of us back at one time. So, this was a way to give them some breathing room by making this kind of thing available, especially for the non-commissioned officers and officers, you know. So that was different. Now, the GI Bill, that's when I came back here. I went to St. Louis U. Well, Stowe Teachers College at first, and then from there to St. Louis U.
And that was all under the GI Bill, was it?
Yeah, that was under the GI Bill.
Yes. Now, it's very interesting. You know, you've been telling me about the attitudes in the United States mm-hmm. before the war, the mm-hmm. sort of racism mm-hmm. that existed, mm-hmm. and how Afro-Americans went, you know, volunteered and were drafted mm-hmm. and fought in the war. Mm-hmm. Having, you know, done all this, what happened to Afro-Americans when you came back after the war? Was there gratitude generally for what you had done in the war?
It was. I don't think it was, because it, they don't know. See, in order for you to be able to appreciate anything, you must have knowledge of it in order to appreciate it. See, with, as I told you, had General Patton lived, the Negro soldier, the black soldier, would have gotten far more, he would have gotten his due recognition. But with him being assassinated, there was no one in that authority, that high, that would give that recognition. So, for example, when I got back, I was at the local drugstore here, pharmacist, you call them, Mueller's Drugstore, and met one of the councilmen that I used to cut grass for while I was a kid in school. And he was glad to see, expressed his gratitude to me that seeing me back, etc., etc. And he began to tell me about some of the progress that he and his administration was making and had made during my absence. And one of the things that he mentioned was the swimming pool. They were building the swimming pool, and they had built the school, Douglas School. I said, "Oh, yes." I said, I notice you are building the swimming pool. I said, "Hurry up and get it finished. I'm going to come up and take a dip, meaning I'm going to swim." So he says, "Oh, no, Benny." He says, "We're going to build you all one over there." Wait a minute. You don't do me any favors. That's mine there. Well, Benny, you know, you and I are all right, but what about the rest of you people? I don't know what you people you're referring to, but hurry up and get it done, and I'm going to come up and take a swim. Benny, look, you and I are all right, as I said, but see, if we did, if you came up there, all them people from Kenlock would be here. Oh, well, why would you think they would come all the way over here to swim?" I said, "I don't think they'd do that." But anyway, He took it seriously, and I went home and forgot about it. So he called a lady who was a business lady. She was the local mortician, and she was a member of the chamber, knowing that she wasn't going to bury any white folks. But nevertheless, that was a conduit. She was a youth to be used to get find out what's going on and to relay messages that would be beneficial to them. So he had called her and asked her to get in touch with somebody because to refrain me from coming to the swimming pool because he feared someone would get hurt. And so Mrs. Lewis called my, she knew better than to call me. She called my mother. Normally, my mother would call the house, and if I were working out in the yard or doing something, Lorraine would say, well, he's busy, I'll call him. Oh, no, don't call him. Just tell him to call me when he comes in, okay? That was her policy. But this particular time, tell him to come here. I want to talk to him right away. So Lorraine yells out, Betty, your mother's on the phone. She says, come there. She wants to talk to you right away. Well, first thing I thought, probably she was ill, you know. When she gives a command like that, I'm stopping everything. I'm running to see what's wrong. We got there, and my mother, very religious, Lord, have mercy, son. What's going on? What are you doing? I said, well, Mom, I'm working out here in the yard and trying to try laying some stone in my flower garden. You aren't going up there to that swimming pool, are you? Oh, no, Mom, well, swimming pool? No, I hadn't even thought about it. Son, you sure you're not going up there? I said, well, not today. Well, please don't go up there, son. Miss Lewis called me, said they're out to get you. So they have a policeman there, and they've got their guns, and if you make an effort to come up there, somebody's going to get hurt. And I thought I'd call you and tell you, please don't go. Will you promise? I said, Mother, I promise I will not go today. But I'm not promising you that I'm not going to go. Son, please, for my sake. I said, okay. So we ended it. But that hurt me that they would stoop to that low ebb to prey on the sympathy of my mom. Okay? So I was more determined than ever to go. So I assembled a group. One of the fellows, he was from the Navy, and he had access to an automobile, his dad's car. And I called there were three newspapers in this area at that time. There was a morning newspaper, which was the Globe Democrat, the afternoon newspaper, which was the St. Louis Star-Times, and the evening paper, which was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But at that time, the St. Louis Star-Times was the most liberal newspaper. So I contacted them. I wanted a third party. My experience in the Army was always to have in something of that nature that's so hostile, get some white disinterested party, because what the American white man at that day thought, it was that if there wasn't a white man, a white person standing up there to verify, then it didn't happen. Because they just couldn't stand a black person. His word was nothing. Okay, so we had a pact with the St. Louis Star-Times newspaper. The guy said yes. He would. He was a young fella and very very articulate and so forth. He says, "I'll be wearing a crew cut, and I'll have a polka dot tie." That was the identification. So we met up there, 2:30. Hot day, very, very warm day. It was in August. And we proceeded to go and line up to apply for our admission. Stood behind the last person in the line, and the reporter was standing off to the side. And got up to the cage. There were three girls in the cage. One of the girls immediately disappeared. And while this girl informed us that she had been given orders not to sell UL tickets. And at that time, the reporter interceded and said, "By whom?" And she said, "The city council." And by that time, the manager came, appeared, and identified himself as his last name was Kloppy, and he was the manager, and that all questions would have to be directed to him, and I'm not answering any questions. So we thanked him, and the king walked out and was standing there on the parking lot talking, and while standing there on the parking lot talking, here comes the riot squad. Policemen, sirens going, and they gets out the cars with their pistols drawn. And here comes the mayor and the city councilman, and they all huddle together. We just looked at them. Now, I suppose we were supposed to run. Had we ran, then they would have had an alibi of shooting, fleeing suspect, what, I don't know. But that would have been the rationale behind shooting us in the back. So anyway, we stood and looked at them, and they looked at us. Finally, we laughed at them. So they put their pistols away. So the reporter then, after we sort of ignored him, said he was going to go over and check with the administration and find out what they had on their minds. So when he went over there, they berated him for not having informed them that we were coming, because they could have, we would have been able to have prevented that. And it's embarrassing, et cetera, et cetera. So the reporter informed that he had no allegiance to inform them of anything. He was that was his business, and so forth and so on. So in the meantime, the conclusion was that we were going to sue. We at that time, you had a black lawyer that had just won a suit. A restrictive covenant case, Shelley versus Kramer, housing at the Supreme Court. And he had decided that he would take our case for $500. And of course we said yes. And before we could raise the $500, he expired. And by me having met Judge McMillan, who was a student at St. Louis University at the same time that I was a student there. He graduated cum magna laude and so forth and so on. I asked him if he would take the case. And he didn't want to take it because it was a civil rights case, and he was of the opinion that they're going to do what they want to do. There's no money in that. It was more money in accident cases and what have you than it was in this civil rights case. And but because of me, he said he would take it for $100. And of course we had that. And I prevailed with him to get a copy of the Virginia brief. The Virginia brief was available. It had already been decided, similar case. And so he did. And we went to court, and we won the suit. Now, the judge didn't want to rule against his peers, but the Virginia brief was so pointed, he had no other alternative. But he said, well, why don't you let them swim every other day? He declared that the city permitted us to swim every other day. The city said, oh, but we'll have to change the water in the pool every other day. So the judge said, well, those are my orders. So the city said, it costs too much money to drain that pool and fill it every other day. So we'll just close it. Well, gee golly, we weren't swimming anyway. They were the ones that were swimming. So the pool cracked for lack of water. And so that was it. So the mayor that was elected on the premises that if we voted for him, he would reopen the pool. Okay, everybody went, voted for him, he reopened the pool, and they had the audacity to call me and ask me how many of you people are going to come up. I said, I don't know. Are you going to come? I don't know. You went through all of this, and I said, I didn't say I wasn't going to come. Well, I want to get some idea. You don't have to get no idea. You don't have to make any special preparation for me. No more so than you make for yourself. Well, I don't want to see any incident. Well, look at yourself. You know? So, in the final analysis, I had to tell him, look, it's a principle. Matter of principle. I have a right. If I can go overseas and fight for an idea or concept that I knew nothing about, certainly I can return here and fight to see it happen, to make it happen. I have the right to go if I want to go. But do not deny me the right to go, even if I don't want to go. That ends up here.
Do you think, Benny, that the war made any difference to black consciousness in America?
Yes. It gave you, it stimulates your thinking. It gave you the people there to exchange of ideas. See, when you are locked into a cocoon, nothing comes in, nothing goes out. You become complacent and you rot. You get out, explore, and see. And then you have knowledge. See, when certain people try to control the knowledge, they want all the brains so they can use you as a number, do your thinking for you. Then they can control you. The richer gets richer, the poorer gets poorer. But when you start thinking, then you have some power.
Well, Benny, thank you very much indeed for coming along today.
Thank you.
And telling me about your wartime experience in Britain as well as other places, which has been so interesting.
Thank you.
And also about this post-war situation. I suppose this eventually led to the civil rights movement, did it?
Yes. Uh-huh. And you know what? It's still going on. We still don't have it. We have subtle, there's a certain group of people that runs this country that you don't see. They work behind the scene, okay? And they, if you don't do what they tell you to do, you don't exist.